This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled This Side of the Whirlwind, subtitled The Coming Apocalypse, and even subtitled again The Second Half of Christ's Covenant. This must be a religious book. I don't know. Here's my author, Stephen R. Harrell, joining me from Arizona. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Jay.
Pleasure.
And, yeah, you could call it a religious book.
It is a 400 and some pages. I was looking or glancing through your book. A lot of research, a lot of footnotes, a lot of detail in your book. This must have taken a long time to write. What was the motivation that got you fired up to write about this side of the whirlwind?
Well, I've pretty much known the Lord most of my life, and I'm one of those fortunate individuals that I have actually heard God's voice since I was about nine. And in 1990, a long time ago now, 1990, the Lord decided he was sending me into obscurity. Over the course of several months, he said he was taking me out of the workforce, taking me out of ministry, and sending me into obscurity where I was to wait on him until told otherwise. Well, about 15 years later, that's kind of a long story, but we'll nip it in the bud here. About 15 years later, my life turned around again, and it seemed like God was calling me back in the ministry, but I didn't hear his voice. And so I started praying. About 8 months of prayer, March of 2006, God told me to go to a pastor's conference in Phoenix. I live in Tucson, Arizona. And so I was to go to this pastor's conference in Phoenix where he said he'd give me a word of knowledge. When I got there, I was there just a short while, and the Lord spoke to my spirit and said, Habakkuk 2:3 in the NIV. First time the Lord had ever given me any word that he actually had a version of the Bible picked out for it. And I'll touch on that in a second. But about a week to 10 days later, I was back in Tucson, and a lady friend came to our home. I have a recording studio at home. She came to our home to do some recording. She said, but before we get started, I have a word for you, Steve, the Lord gave me this morning. She pulls out her NIV Bible and turns to Habakkuk 2, verses 2 and 3, which says, then the Lord replied, write down the revelation, make it plain on tablets, so that the herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end and shall not prove false. Though it lingers, or tarries, wait for it, for it will certainly come and not delay. Well, I thought I had my answer. God was telling me to wait on him, to continue to wait on him. And then she said, but Steve, I have another verse. It's in Joel chapter 2, verses 28 through 32. Well, that section deals with the blood moons and the sun, moon, and stars being darkened and the great and dreadful day of the Lord coming. I'm like, wow. Her name is Joni. I said, Joni, how could this apply to my life? She goes, I don't know, but it's what the Lord gave me. And about 3 months later, the summer of 2006, the Lord speaks to me and says, I want you to write a book on the end times. And I'm thinking, wow, Lord, what do I know about the end times? Fortunately, God gave me not only the revelation and the information to make it possible for me to write this book, but he gave me a burning desire, a drive that literally drove me for 10 years to write the book. And thus, there is the book.
And it's taken you 10 years to complete this? Is that the correct understanding of what's happened?
Correct, yeah, 10 years.
10 years.
10 years of applying myself to get this book accomplished. And frankly, I didn't really know the information, almost any of the information in the book. Most of it's fairly new, even to Christendom overall.
Is the content of your book, is this something that you were aware of or had knowledge of prior to, say, the 2006 or 7 when you began writing this? Is this a view of the end times or a prophecy that you had learned or studied as you were growing up?
Actually, everything that I had learned about the end times, with a few exceptions, God would give me a revelation that had to do with this side of the world, when the great consummation story within or message within the book. I would try to apply the stuff I knew from before to write the book, and then God would give me another piece of information maybe a month or 6 months later and how to confirm what he was showing me. And I'd have to go and take out the stuff I'd put in. And that happened over and over again. I basically had to rewrite the book about 8 or 9 times because all of the back information I'd had from the different churches and the different theology I'd been taught conflicted with what the Lord had shown me. So the book is, a great deal of the book has never before been presented to Christendom.
So are you saying that your viewpoint or the viewpoint in your book is, I won't say in conflict, but is in a different view than what maybe most have seen in their study of Scripture and the book of Revelation?
Absolutely correct. And the reason for that is simply this. God said to Daniel, and he said to John, he said, seal up the vision until the time of the end. They were instructed to hold back a portion of the end times message until the time of the end. It was what the seven thunders uttered for John. And with Daniel, it was seal up the little book and conceal the information. So it wasn't the entire message, but a portion of the end times message was concealed and was not going to be released until the very end of the latter days or the time of the end. And so we know from that right there that God did not give us all of the revelation for the end times, that some was hidden, only to be revealed in the last days. So it only makes sense that the messages that we have been working with for centuries, millennia here, that they didn't have all of the information. So the new information, it conflicted with the ideologies and thoughts that were developed with only, for lack of a better term, half of the information available. The whirlwind represents that second half of the information, or whatever the ratio is. I don't know what the ratio is, but it presents that missing information, and that missing information is about the completion of the covenant Jesus began in his first 3.5 years of ministry.
And is that what explained for my listeners who may not have a theology background or even a church background, or that might have a curiosity about this side of the whirlwind, the coming apocalypse? What would be the shocking revelation, if you want to call it that, in your book that may be different from or may challenge their current beliefs of the end times?
Well, for the Christians that already are kind of settled in the current end times doctrines, a lot of people have the idea of the Great Tribulation doctrine, the idea that we will be raptured before the Great Tribulation, because the Great Tribulation is the wrath of God. And we're not appointed under wrath, which is true.
Right.
So they're assuming that the tribulation period spoken of in the Word is the wrath of God. What the Lord has shown me in this side of the whirlwind is that first half of the covenant, that first 3.5 years, because there is a 7-year covenant.
Yes.
But that first half that Jesus fulfilled brought the blessings half of the covenant. You know, in Deuteronomy 11, God said, if you obey me, a blessing. If you disobey me, a curse or judgment. And that's terribly paraphrased, but Deuteronomy chapter 11.
It works.
The first half of the covenant, Jesus brought this blessings component that he fulfilled for 3.5 years. The second half of the covenant is the separation of the body of Christ, separating the wheat from the chaff, the wheat from the tares, so that God can bring the wrath of God, the judgment portion, on of the appropriate segment of humanity. 2.5 years the world will endure a period of tribulation to separate true Christians from, I call them pseudo-Christians or the lukewarm, the sold-out Christians, true Christians, those who are not fully committed, the lukewarm. The whole function, the purpose behind the tribulation period is to separate the true Christians from the pseudo-Christians.
Interesting.
The last portion of the Great Consummation spans about a year. It right at the end of the tribulation period, the body of Christ is raptured. They go to meet the Lord in the sky. Then immediately after that, the second apocalypse comes and brings the wrath of God on everyone who has either not accepted Jesus as Lord or who had done so but foolishly took the mark, bowed before the beast or his image. Because that tribulation period is going to be rough. It's a crucible. It's designed to be rough, to separate out the wheat from the chaff.
Your book, is this something that would appeal to non-Christians, non-believers, or is this more directed towards maybe Bible study scholars and people who have a curiosity about end-time events?
Well, I think the book should appeal to pretty much everyone. I mean, there would be a small group of people that would not, but especially Christians. I mean, all over the world, believers and non-believers alike are seeking answers to end times questions. Questions like, when is the rapture going to take place? And what's the point of Christ's second coming? And is there actually a third coming called the second advent? Is the tribulation period the wrath of God, which I prove in the book that it is not? And, you know, questions about the Battle of Armageddon, when it's going to happen, why it's going to happen. One of the things I found interesting is that the book explains why the prophets concealed the information, why God is revealing that information today at this juncture, and what Christians are supposed to do with this new revelation. It's not new scriptures, it's just new revelation off of the existing scriptures.
Your book is, from what you're describing, is different from others that are in the marketplace. Is that a good way to describe it?
I would agree. It's very different. There's a revelation that's not been there for nearly 2,600 years that God concealed. See, God concealed it, and it's not been concealed by man. So, to begin with, I'd say the message in this side of the whirlwind, the Great Tribulation message is about judgment. The Great Consummation message is about completing the covenant Jesus began. You know, in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, it says, "He, Jesus, shall confirm a covenant with many, not everyone, the way is wide to destruction and narrow to salvation, for 1 week." So he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, 7 years. And in the middle of the week, 3.5 years, he shall cause a sacrifice and the offerings to cease. Jesus died on that cross. The veil was rent in two. The Holy of Holies was despoiled. The sacrifices and offerings came to an end. Why was Jesus' ministry 3.5 years? I mean, Moses' was 40. Paul's was over 30. And the Son of the Living God, his ministry was only 3.5 years. Had to be a reason, and there it is. The half of the week, the half of the 7 years, Jesus fulfilled the first half of the covenant. And every scriptural reference to the what people call the Great Tribulation, or I call the Great Consummation, is only for 3.5 years. Yeah, it's amazing. It is an amazing message.
Yeah, that interpretation of Daniel is a little different from the traditional church. They have taken that 3.5 years and allocated it to the beast. Is that, am I understanding, is my recollection of Daniel correct on the traditional?
You are correct. That is one of the misinterpretations that took place. And I think that's one of the things where God, you know, the word talks about that God blinded the Israelites so that they could be ransomed and that the body of Christ could be born. And so that he could save not just the Israelites, but people all over the world. That blinding in part that it talks about in Romans chapter 11, verse 25, I believe it is.
Right.
You know, that blinding in part, the world has had a blinding in part where God has concealed this information. That aspect about being that pronoun, he shall confirm a covenant, being the beast.
Right.
The three verses before it, Daniel 9, 24, 25, and 26, speaks twice. Using a Hebrew word, and I'm always a little reluctant to try to pronounce Hebrew words, but it looks like it's pronounced Nagid. That one word, Nagid, is the only word at that time of Daniel that spoke to a ruler of noble background, of noble character. There were 16 other words that Daniel could have used to write and say, the Messiah, the prince, or the people of the prince. But in both cases, when it used the word prince, it used the word Nagid. There is no allusion whatsoever to an entity that is a negative character. So the pronoun from verse 27 alludes back to either verse 26 just before, which is likely the case, or 25 before that, where it talks about Messiah, the prince, or the people of the prince. I have a section within the book that thoroughly confirms that the pronoun he in verse 27 is emphatically talking about people of the prince there, being a man of noble themes. And then I explain it in that chapter very thoroughly. I think it'll be very difficult for people to, now that the blinders have been removed, the world has access to this knowledge now. I think it'll be very difficult for people to say that it's incorrect.
Well, it's fascinating. You have over 400 pages of research and also footnotes and other observations about Scripture and about the end times. The title of the book, again, is This Side of the Whirlwind, The Coming Apocalypse. And my author has been Stephen R. Harrell. Stephen, where do my listeners get a copy of your book?
Wow, it is everywhere. So you can get it on Amazon.com, Westbo Press. You can go there. I have a website, This Side of the Whirlwind. You can go there. My blog site, This Side of the Whirlwind. Everything's This Side of the Whirlwind. You can go to Barnes and Nobles. You can go to your local bookstores. I don't know if they have it on their shelves at this exact moment, but every bookstore I've been to pretty much has it, especially if it's Christian-based.
Fabulous. And they can also request it by name. Again, This Side of the Whirlwind is the title. Harrell is spelled H-A-R-R-E-L if you're doing a search online, and Stephen is with a V. What's the next step? Are you planning to do a follow-up book to this?
Not at this moment. This thing is growing. It's so large that I think I have my hands full. I'm going to get into the studio and start doing some recording. I recently wrote a theme song for the book, and it turned out really well, kind of a calypso.
Ah.
And though that's not the style for this day and age, people have fun with it. So it's getting out there, getting the word and the book in the hands of the people. I mean, you can get it online for just $5. We're definitely not in it about the money. We want this in the hands of the people, the body of Christ.
Well, thank you for sharing your story and sharing the background inspiration behind the book, This Side of the Whirlwind. Thank you for joining me today. My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing Westbo Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors, all quilters just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Secret Life of a Doctor's Wife, and the author, Rebecca McLeod. She joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Westbo Publishing. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
Great to have you with us. Now, we're going to go down a road that, well, it's not supposed to happen, is it? When you get a vasectomy, that's supposed to be it, but you suddenly, with you and your husband, had a very surprising development that you never expected. It was a new baby after how many years?
It was 9 years after his vasectomy. So by the time she was born, our youngest had just turned 11. So, yeah.
So
big surprise, big change.
Big surprise. And women go through a lot of issues, a lot of emotional problems, challenges with pregnancies and with postpartum, and it's very difficult often to talk about.
I agree. I'm so glad you brought that up. First of all, the surprise. We thought we were done. Our kids were getting older. My husband is an Army physician, and so we were looking forward to that next phase of our life. And I talk in the book about, if I thought if I could control my fate, my fertility, then I could control my fate. And I think over time, things have really shifted for women in our ability to make choices about when we have kids and how many kids we have. But in this case, you know, we thought it was a closed book. I mean, this chapter was over in our life. And you know, when my husband had his vasectomy done 2 years after our third child was born, the doctor said, "Are you sure that you don't want to have any more kids? Because the way I do this procedure, it cannot be reversed." And my husband said, "Yes, we're done. We're done." And so, you know, fast forward 9 years, and I am pregnant, and we were just both in complete shock. How in the world could this happen? And the nurse that told me the news over the phone, she said, "Honey, I would get a hold of that doctor if I were you." That's all I'm telling you. So we never did go back to the doctor, but it was definitely a shock. And you're right, women do go through immense changes and immense adjustments. And you know, as we've talked to people about this, it's just so interesting and sometimes comical to hear their reaction, because you know, it's common when you tell people, "Look, you know, my husband's vasectomy failed." They'll ask me, "How old are your kids?" And I'll say, "You know, they're, you know, now they're 23, 20, 16, oh, and 4." And so we'll often get into that conversation, and I found out that it happens more than you realize, but some women have just absolutely gone pale when I've told, I mean, we strike fear into the heart of so many couples when we tell them the story, because they also think, "Hey, we're done, you know, this is over for us." So yes, it is a big, big adjustment.
So your book is about processing your emotions when life throws you a curveball.
Yeah, you know, I often wonder why life happens so much faster than our hearts are able to process it, Steve. You know, things happen in life. If you've been on this planet any length of time, you've had to deal with some kind of major change that you were not expecting. And it can even be a good change. I mean, obviously, a baby's a wonderful blessing. But it's a big adjustment. It's a big responsibility. But there's lots of other unexpecteds in life. You know, you could experience a job loss or an illness. There's plenty of things that come to us in life that require immense flexibility and immense change and adjustment in our hearts. So, it definitely, the book was a way of me to process being back at the starting line of motherhood again. How I felt about it, and how difficult it was for me often to feel validated in the struggle. You know, I would go to people at church and tell them about it, and they'd say, "Oh, that's just a blessing. She was meant to be." And yes, she is a blessing, and she was meant to be, but it doesn't erase the fact that it was incredibly hard to start over at that point in my life.
You call your book a collection of essays that chronicles this journey because of all these major changes. So tell us about how your book is structured.
For 7 years prior to having the baby, I was touring as an independent gospel singer and songwriter, and was really enjoying that. I also had a job as a staff worship leader at my church, so I was very busy in music. When the pregnancy happened, I worked through the pregnancy, but after I had the baby, I just really went into a really bad postpartum depression, which I talked some about in the book, and it was just a very scary time for me. I postponed getting treatment longer than I should have, and that's one thing I want to get out there to women. If you know, if you're struggling with depression, don't wait. Please get help. It's very serious, and it can be treated, but you have to get support. You have to get the help you need. So I did go through that, and as I was sort of processing through my physical healing and the adjustment, I began to write. I had stopped doing the music. I kind of just dropped everything because of the major adjustment that it required, and because of the depression, I took some time. So when the baby was sleeping, or when I couldn't sleep at night, I would start writing. And what came out first were just some random, you know, musings and some old memories from childhood, because I think change in general makes old things surface, and it calls for some inner reflection. So I began just doing some writing, and what came out of that over the next year, I began writing, sharing some of those pieces on a blog, which is called Monday's Muse. So I started sharing every Monday little bits and pieces of things that I had written. So I have been doing that now for over two and a half years. And I had always dreamed of writing a book. It's just something that I've always wanted to do. So what I did was I gathered some of my favorite pieces from the blog over the last couple of years and sort of put them together by subject. So I have a section on parenting and on family, on faith. And then there's some funny stuff that's under frustration. And there's this combination of family stories, but it also does chronicle. I think the thread that sort of binds it all together is, you know, that change takes time to process. Adjustment takes time, and we have to give ourselves the space to do that, the permission even to do that, to make to make those adjustments, to come to terms with our new normal.
Well, you've had some great reviews. One says she's witty and snarky and first one to laugh at the absurdity. Now, you have to laugh, don't you?
Yes, it is life-saving. It really is. And I grew up in a family, a wonderfully crazy family from New Orleans that that loved to laugh. You know, we laughed. We had our dysfunctions for sure, but we laughed through them all. And I think they just taught me that humor is just invaluable. A lot of times when you just want to cry, you have to laugh. So I did. Several of these stories are just funny. They're about some crazy things that have happened in our family, some crazy things that I've been through. And I just tend to, when I write, for some reason that just comes out. I think it's just part of who I am. It's part of what I love. I just love to laugh. It's healing.
Very healing. I think we don't obviously laugh enough, especially when the crazy stuff happens, the unexpected. As someone said, oh, someday we're going to laugh. And then they said, well, why don't we laugh now?
True. It's true. That is necessary. It really is in perspective, because we can go inward and we can just crumble under the pressures of life, you know, or we can sort of like get up a little bit higher, a bigger perspective and realize that, you know what, everything is temporary in this life. It's this, you know, as hard as the season may be, it's going to pass, and the child is going to grow up, and you're, you know, whatever's happened to you, you're going to adjust, you're going to move on. So it helps bring perspective. It helps bring lightness to sometimes a very heavy, hard period in our lives.
And you want to encourage women not only to take care of themselves, but to drop the mother's guilt. Now, explain what you mean.
Well, I'm so glad you asked that, Steve, because I think today in our culture, in our society today, women are just expected to carry so much. We're just expected to you know, we're expected to have these careers, and we're expected to have kids, and we're expected to, you know, cart them to all their activities so we can keep up with what everybody else is doing. And, you know, it seems like in other generations, when you had children, there just wasn't as much movement. And I just think there's so much movement today. We're running here, running there, and trying to make sure our kids get everything they need, make sure, you know, we're succeeding at work, make sure our marriages are thriving. There's just so much pressure. So I think one of the biggest things, and Brené Brown talks about this in her book, Daring Greatly, and she talks about it in some of her TED Talks too, that, you know, for women, the two major shame issues are how we look and how we mother. And those are really the inroads into the deepest feelings of shame that we as women face. You know, you can insult us in any way, but if you insult how we look or you insult the way we mother, that really gets to our identity, our core. So I think what I'm trying to say through the book is, you know, we have to, yes, our, you know, taking care of our kids is important. They need a lot for sure. But if we don't, if we don't put the oxygen mask on ourselves first, our kids don't really ultimately have a chance, because we have to take care of ourselves. We have, self-care is paramount, especially when we're under extra stress in the middle of major change. There's a lot of women that are, you know, going through divorce. You need extra self-care, extra time to take care of yourself when you're going through stressful events. And I just think often we just push through, we just plow on through, and our physical health is often compromised, certainly our mental health, and often both. So yes, we got to get rid of the guilt, we got to drop the guilt, and we have to say, you know what, I've got to take care of myself, or I'm not going to be any good for anyone else.
Well, your book, The Secret Life of a Doctor's Wife, is obviously much more than just what many might think about being a doctor's wife. Very privileged weekly pedicures and, you know, gated communities. And but you're talking about the hard realities of life.
Yeah, I don't think any of us are immune to real life. You know, we can pretend and we can put on masks when we go out in public, but you know, the problems that we face as human beings are, you know, they're really no respecter of you know, economics or education. You know, we all face trials and hardships and unexpected. So, yeah, I think, you know, the title obviously was catchy, it rhymes, but, This book is really just about, it's about the messy underbelly of life, which, you know, I hopefully talk about in a very real and vulnerable way. Because I think, you know, I think we recognize real gut level honesty when we hear it. And I hope that's what women will recognize when they read this book. They'll feel like they've sat down with a real friend, a good friend, and had a cup of coffee and felt, you know, feel somewhat validated in whatever it is they're struggling with. Because we do all face many of the same struggles.
Well, you've gotten some great reviews. Let me read one more. Rebecca so effortlessly shares her life, her soul, her pain, that a reader instantly falls in love. you really are personal.
Thank you. Thank you. It has been a wonderful, wonderful experience being able to share this. And I just, you know, I hope to offer some hope, certainly some laughter, some encouragement. I don't think, you know, I think we can all use that any given day of the week. I know I can. So hopefully that's what people will get when they pick up a copy. And, yeah, hopefully walk away just feeling like maybe their hearts are full and encouraged and that, you know, they know they're not alone in their struggles in life.
Again, the title, The Secret Life of a Doctor's Wife. How do we get your book, Rebecca?
Well, it is available on westbowpress.com and also at Amazon.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you so much, Steve.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Westbow Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat. And as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Blue View Island, and the author is Jacqueline Frist. And Jacqueline joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Jacqueline.
Hi.
Great to have you with us. Now, we want everyone to know this is first-time author, and she is 14 years of age. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Quite an experience, right?
Yeah.
Was it more than you ever expected?
Yeah.
A lot more,
huh? It just started out as a project, and it's gone so far.
Well, this story, Blue View Island, it's the story of Jace, and he goes to this deserted island for the summer with his twin sister. Of course, the island, they didn't know beforehand, is filled with mysteries, and it's up to them, and they meet a bunch of other teenage friends to uncover the island's secret. So that's kind of the overall theme of the book.
It is.
So why did you write it?
Well, one of my friends a few years ago started writing this story, and when I was reading it, I decided to start writing one of my own. And so even though she didn't really finish hers, I decided to keep going with mine. She encouraged me until I finished it.
So I guess perseverance is the key.
It really is.
You can do more than you ever thought you could do.
Yep. She inspired me, and I started to write, and I took it way farther than I thought I ever would.
So summer's coming up, and Jace isn't sure what's going to happen, and he and his twin sister, Terry, are told that they're going to go see their grandfather. They don't know very much about him, do they?
They really don't. They've never met him. Their mom doesn't tell them much about him, which is kind of part of the mystery of the island. They don't even really know their grandfather who stays there and owns the island.
So this fantasy island is where?
It's off the coast of California, which is near where they live in California, and it's so it's off the coast there, and it's just kind of in the middle of the ocean.
So what are they feeling before going? What are they feeling about the summer?
Well, I know that Terry is pretty excited at the beginning of the book to be there, but Jace isn't really looking forward to like a summer there. He doesn't think it's going to be as great as his sister does, and he's also not really sure what it's going to be like. He's not really sure what he'll experience there.
So he thinks it's just going to be boring.
Yes, he does.
Nothing worse for a teenager than a boring summer.
Yeah.
However, he meets someone special when he gets there.
He does.
Tell us about her.
Well, her name's Livia, and when he meets her, they both have common interests, and they both like to do the same things, and they begin to hang out with each other in kind of the foresty part of the island, because that's where they kind of found a special bond, and they both like to hang out there and do fun stuff together.
And, of course, they meet up with some other folks, too. There's some other teenagers that are looking for a summer of fun. Tell us about Zach and Emmett.
So Zach and Emmett are both really friendly, and they love – all the people on the island are always really friendly, and they all almost instantly became friends with Jason and Terry. And since they're the same age, they all hang out during the book, and later on they end up being like even greater friends than before.
But something very mysterious happens. Jace discovers something that is more than he could ever expect.
He does. As the story continues, he and his friends, but especially him, they notice strange things on the island, and they begin to notice it more and more. And of course, they become curious about it, and the more they search for these strange things, the more they see, and that kind of unfolds the mystery.
So there's this curious oval piece of silver that really changes everything.
There is. He finds this piece of silver with the words Agris on it, and this bird helps him find it, this curious bird, he starts to follow it around because it seems to know what it's doing. And so when he follows it, he finds the Agris, and after fiddling with it some, he finally looks through it. But when he looks through it, everything looks dull and dead, and everything looks black and white, and just everything completely destroyed. But when he looks at the bird, it's bright red and still alive. So he and his sister soon find out that it actually shows things that are kind of strange and like things that are not normal, that helps them spot those things.
So the island has secrets. Can you give us any kind of clue or hint without giving everything away?
Well, one night during a campfire, Jace seems to see this shadowy figure off to the side on the dark side of the beach. And it seems okay at first, it's someone taking a walk, but it just gives off a strange vibe. And Jace has a strange feeling about it. And they definitely do see this figure later on in the book. And that's one of the greatest mysteries of the island.
So is there danger at any time?
Yes, the figure is kind of one of the dangers that they face while on the island. And they also learn that there are dangers in the future to come.
So we're not only talking about what they're experiencing during this summer, but what could be coming up in the future for the island or for themselves or what else?
Mostly for themselves, but also if they don't contain this danger, then it could spread to everyone else in the world. And so they have to, they pretty much have to protect the world from the danger.
Do they have any other helpers from that maybe unseen world?
They have a few helpers, a few people who kind of are going to help them along the way. Not in this book right now, but in the next book, there will be people who kind of help them along the way. And then they also have these magical amulets that help them. And when they put them on, it gives them a certain power, like a superpower. So Jace, the main character, he has this amulet that he puts on that helps him move things around with his mind, as well as fly, because he can move himself around with his mind. And he can also sense things that are that you can't see with the bare eye. And so Livia also has an amulet that turns her into a firebender, and she can create fires and move them at her will. And so there are other amulets, but they still need to find them.
So it certainly wasn't a boring summer.
It definitely was not.
Not a boring summer. You've already mentioned that you mentioned the next book, so tell us about that.
Well, the next book I'm currently working on, and there may be a third book, but I'm not sure. It depends on how well the second book plays out, because I have some ideas, but I don't know if I'll get more ideas about it or if I'll end up stretching out ideas to make it longer than I thought it would. So there may be a second book, maybe a third book. I'm not sure. Well, I know there's going to be a second book, but I'm not sure if there's going to be a third book or not.
Well, you mentioned in describing your story to me earlier that you hit a writer's block. Explain that for other would-be authors, up-and-coming authors. What was that like? What happened?
Well, usually I just get minor writer's blocks just every now and then, just for maybe like a week, and I can write a little bit, but I don't have that much ideas. But during the writing, maybe about halfway through, I had no ideas, bone dry. I hit the biggest writer's block, and I could not think of anything. And that just made me feel really discouraged, and I wasn't really sure what to write. I knew I didn't want to end the book there. I knew I wasn't going to stop writing, but I just didn't know how to continue. But then one day, I started just thinking and thinking, and all of a sudden, so many ideas came to me, and I thought, I just have to get this down on paper. And so I immediately started writing, and I finally got all these ideas back to me again. And so I guess what I have to say about writer's block is that it's not going to last forever. So you just got to keep thinking until you get more ideas.
And in your case, it literally did take a few weeks before you broke through. So I guess you have to persevere, right?
Yep.
Just like your characters.
Yeah. So, I mean, they just got to keep going, just like I did with my book.
Well, Jacqueline, again, congratulations on writing
your
first novel and already writing the second one. And who knows where all this is leading. The title is Blue View Island. And we've been talking to Jacqueline Frist. She is of the old age of 14 years. And here she is, already an accomplished author. So where do we find your book? How can we get it?
Well, you can get it on Amazon. And you can also get it on Barnes & Noble and Archway Publishing. And you can also go on my website, blueviewisland.com, and you can also order it there.
Very good, blueviewisland.com. Well, thank you so much, Jacqueline, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.